New data on salt in the diet.
New recommendations on aspirin to prevent cardiovascular disease.
Non-alcoholic steatohepatitis and a potential new treatment.
And the different immune responses to different COVID vaccines.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, let's turn right to the New England Journal of Medicine. This is a look at the different COVID-19 vaccines and the kinetics of immune responses to those.
When we talk about kinetics, we're talking about the rise and fall of the immune responses to the three vaccines that are approved in the United States. It's a relatively simple study with a relatively small number of patients in which they looked at the antibody response after full vaccination, 2 weeks after the second dose. And also, by the way, they looked at 6 months and 8 months after that. For both the mRNA vaccines, they had higher peak antibodies. By the way, they measured three different antibodies, the neutralizing antibody, the pseudovirus neutralizing antibody, and also the binding antibody. But in all of these, there was a pretty robust response to the vaccine. Interestingly, these declined over the 6 to 8 months significantly. Whereas the J&J vaccine, it had a more modest initial immune response, but it was sustained for 6 to 8 months. It really didn't decline very much. When you compare the two mRNA vaccine, a little bit more of an immune response with Moderna, there was a big difference in terms of antibody response. Some people, the titer is as small as 100 to as much as 10,000. What do you do with that information? Well, that's a great question because to date, we know that these vaccines, especially mRNA vaccines, are 95% effective in preventing infection and serious infection, despite the fact there's a huge variation in the antibody response. So we don't have a good correlation. This is interesting data, but I don't want any of our listeners to think, oh gosh, I have more antibodies than somebody else, and therefore I'm better off. We don't have any data to show that that is the case.
Yeah, it's such a shame that antibodies are such a poor surrogate for immunity. I don't think that anybody really understands, to harken back to this term, kinetics, the kinetics of that.
And unfortunately, we've been focusing on the wrong thing. We've been focusing on antibody numbers and not the protection provided by various vaccines.
Yeah, it's unclear to me, though, how we would structure a study that would address the latter, because that would really require challenge with live virus. And or maybe you can think of another way we could assess that.
It would require a large number of individuals with varying antibody responses, both T-cell and B-cell antibody responses, and also immune memory responses to ascertain whether any of these components or all of these components actually confer immunity. Those studies are actually in the works right now, Elizabeth.
I guess I would just note that the most recent data from the CDC and a real-life look at this shows that people who are fully vaccinated are 11 times less likely to be hospitalized with COVID than those who are not. So that's a pretty compelling statistic, I think.
And I'd focus on that rather than absolute antibody levels.
Since we're talking about things that affect us globally, let's turn to two different publications that I'm going to treat together. One is from the BMJ Open, and it's taking a look at the salt content of two different types of foods in five countries around the world. And the other one is the FDA's guidance domestically on voluntary salt restriction guidelines for food manufacturers in the United States. So turning to the study first, what it did was to compare the sodium content in processed meat and fish products. The countries were China, Australia, South Africa, the UK, and the USA. China had the highest sodium level. That was followed by us here in the US, then South Africa, Australia. And the lowest levels were found in the UK. But I got to tell you, I got a chuckle out of the fact that in the UK, the one product that was still saltier than anything and anywhere was bacon. They cite this thing that's somewhat controversial, that high sodium intake is the major cause of high blood pressure and increases the risk of cardiovascular disease, renal disease, and premature mortality. We know that that's kind of a squishy target because there are some people who are more susceptible to it than others. in the FDA's guidance then to trying to reduce the sodium content also in prepackaged foods, but not meat and fish exclusively, but everything, they cite a statistic that more than 70% of total sodium intake is from sodium added during food manufacturing and commercial food preparations. And that our average sodium intake here in the United States is approximately 3,400 milligrams per day. They're attempting to provide some uniform metrics for voluntary sodium reduction, focusing on the total amount of sodium in a given food as opposed to individual sodium-containing ingredients, and then support and extend the industry's voluntary efforts to reduce sodium across the full range of these things.
Elizabeth, you might ask yourself, will voluntary reductions actually work? Only one of them is it legislatively mandated. That's in South Africa. The others all have voluntary reductions recommended. And they, in fact, they are effective. This can be a very effective way of getting us down from about 3,400 grams per day to less than 2,000, which is where we ought to be. We have to make sure that we don't put in other things that are just as harmful, that is more sugar or more fats, to compensate. I applaud both of these articles.
You wouldn't mandate the reduction of salt in prepared foods here in the United States.
I just don't think it's necessary. You talk about the countries that have the lowest, the United Kingdom. There's nothing mandated in the United Kingdom. It's all voluntary.
In the FDA's document, they project that if this pattern of reduction of sodium in processed foods actually took place, it would prevent between 280,000 and 500,000 premature deaths over 10 years. I'd just like you to comment on the fact that we have discussed the controversy relative to salt sensitivity, if you will, with regard to the development of hypertension, because not everybody is susceptible to that.
No, they aren't. So we look at this on the basis of a population. So we're talking about a population reduction in salt. And when the entire population does, we decrease deaths by about 250,000.
Now let's turn to the USPSTF's preliminary guidance on aspirin with regard to cardiovascular disease prophylaxis, if you will.
So Elizabeth, in our 18 plus years of doing the podcast, this is the first time I can recall us talking about a USPSTF preliminary report, but this is open for public content and the recommendations have changed. They're going to provide what are called grade C and grade D recommendations for the following. People 40 to 59 should decide with their clinician whether to start taking an aspirin to prevent cardiovascular disease, and people 60 or older should not start taking an aspirin. I want to take a step back for a second because my concern is that people that are already taking aspirin are going to see these ages and suddenly stop their aspirin. That's not what this is talking about. This is talking about people that don't have any risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And in those individuals already not taking aspirin, the harm of starting it in terms of gastrointestinal bleeding or intracranial hemorrhage or intracranial stroke is higher than the benefit of aspirin. Everybody that's listening to us and wondering whether they should take aspirin or not, I encourage you to talk to your healthcare provider. If you're not taking aspirin, should you start it? If you're taking it, should you continue it?
My initial look at this data also suggests that there's an age stratification.
That's clear, because the older you get, the more likely you are to either A, benefit from aspirin, but B, also to have the complications associated with aspirin use. It just depends on the balance of risk factors among the individuals, and that's what needs to be weighed.
Are there any other agents that are out there that you would recommend for people who are concerned about this particular risk that are not aspirin?
Well, so it's interesting. You say, well, why did aspirin seem to be beneficial before and not now? That's because we're doing other things that are beneficial. People are taking statins now, and that lowers their cardiovascular risk. People are controlling their diabetes. That lowers their risk, although most diabetics should be on aspirin. People are taking their antihypertensive medications, and their blood pressure is coming down.
And we're going to, of course, get the last word on this at some point. Let's turn back to the New England Journal of Medicine. I served it up as non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, but the first study is taking a look at non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And it's really a survey of, well, where are we with this right now? So this study takes a look at 1,773 adults with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and followed them for a median of 4 years. They took a look at fibrosis, which is an indication that clearly the disease is progressing, and the association of mortality with that. They also looked at liver-related complications and associated that with the fibrosis state, as well as other things like diabetes. basically what they found is that those patients with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease with fibrosis stages 3 and 4, which are at the end of the spectrum, do have increased risks of liver-related complications and death. And this, of course, is not surprising. It turns out that this non-alcoholic fatty liver disease affects more than 1/4 of the adult population globally. And it's also closely linked to underlying obesity, type 2 diabetes, and other disorders that are related to that. I would note, however, that I've seen plenty of people who didn't have these risk factors who also ended up hospitalized with these complications. Do you want to comment on that briefly before we talk about the medicine that they're investigating?
Yeah. For those listeners that may not be familiar, there are different stages. You mentioned one, fatty liver. It's oftentimes associated with type 2 diabetes, but not always, and usually associated with insulin resistance. The progression is they start with fatty deposits in the liver, and then they develop inflammation. That's called the steatohepatitis. And then it goes from inflammation to where the liver cells die and they're replaced with scar tissue. That's called the fibrosis that you mentioned. And the final stage, cirrhosis. That predisposes to some of the other complications, severe gastrointestinal bleeding, and ultimately liver cancer as well.
Yeah. So the good news is that the other study reports on the use of a medication that's called lanifibranor, and it's a pan-PPAR, that's peroxisome proliferator activated receptor agonist. I always love those things, don't you? They just trip off the tongue. And it modulates metabolic, inflammatory, and fibrogenic pathways in the pathogenesis of non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. So as you mentioned, that condition that's on that continuum. This study took people who had that, and they were randomly assigned in a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio to receive either 1,200 milligrams of lanifibranor or 800 milligrams or a placebo once daily for 24 weeks. They had 247 patients who underwent randomization. 103 also had type 2 diabetes. 76% of them had significant or advanced fibrosis in their liver. This agent was able to really help in the folks at the higher dose, but the 800 milligram dose really didn't have the impact, although it did help in some things, liver enzymes and some of the worsening of fibrosis. What about the side effects? Diarrhea, nausea, peripheral edema, anemia, and weight gain among a group of people who were already pretty heavy. So that's a troubling aspect to this. The authors, of course, recommending that it goes forward into a phase 3 trial.
This particular, I'm going to call PPAR agonist, there are 3 different isotypes. This is an agonist for all 3. So this is the first agent that's been shown to decrease the inflammation and also to decrease fibrosis as well. Now, these are surrogate endpoints. And as you described the first paper, the more extensive or the further along in the disease, the more likely you are to die. So the thought is if you can prevent these surrogate endpoints, you can actually improve survival. So that would be the longer study of this particular agent.
To me, what this speaks to is we need to figure out why we're globally experiencing so much of this and how we're going to intervene.
Absolutely. The other thing about this particular study is it had very few minorities in it. Does this extend to other racial and ethnic groups? Some of those actually have a greater predisposition to the hepatitis.
Yeah. The mean age of these patients in this study was 54 years and their BMI was 33. 58% were female and 94% were white. So your point is well taken. We definitely need to expand for the next study the number of folks who are included.
More to come on this, but it seems like a promising agent.
Okay. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.